Welcome to the Ralston College Podcast. I'm Stephen Blackwood. Today's episode is a conversation with the classicist, commentator, and almond farmer, Victor Davis Hanson. It may seem that this last, his almond farming, is only a quaint hobby, unrelated to his primary occupation as a writer and thinker. But that is fundamentally, I think, to misunderstand Victor Davis Hanson. Dr. Hanson's thinking is profoundly informed by his experience of agriculture. One of the things he and I discuss in this conversation is the catastrophic remove of academics from the consequences of the ideas they espouse. Most academics today have very little skin in the game. Most have never made anything, run, let alone started a business, grown any food, fought any fires, driven a truck, slaughtered an animal, defended the country, or provided any of the essential services on which their own lives depend. And yet, many of them frequently and openly advocate for ideas that would seriously affect all of these domains. This is, it needs to be said, highly anomalous from a historical perspective. The widespread divorce between doing and thinking is a relatively new phenomenon. People like Thomas Jefferson, for example, were inventors, farmers, statesmen, as well as conceptual philosophical thinkers at a high level. The irony of our knowledge economy is that our knowledge workers know less about how things work than scholars at any time in history, who were never, or at least rarely, as distant from the real world as many intellectuals are today. This has a disastrous effect on policy and on our institutional life at every level. Without the correction of reality, without being brought face to face in the short term with the consequences of our ideas, we can perpetuate only partially true or even wildly false ideas. We need thinkers. I mean, we can't understand anything, not the world, not our history, not ourselves, without thinking about them. But thinking is only powerful so far as it is true, so far as it interprets reality as it really is. Perhaps what we need are the citizen farmer soldiers that Hanson so eloquently writes about, women and men who have intellectual firepower and who are close enough to the consequences of their ideas. People who understand, as Aristotle did, that life without thought is unaware, ignorant, and meaningless, while thought disconnected from life is weak, insubstantial, and dangerous. We're facing a terrible stagnancy in our cultural and intellectual life. Tragically, at the very moment that we have huge problems to solve, political rancor, civic alienation, inner-city violence, suicide, opioid and dopamine addiction, familial, cultural, artistic, and educational breakdown, and so on and so forth, and we desperately need young women and men who can really think these things through, people who will do the hard work of understanding the world in all its depth and complexity and beauty. People distinguished not by isolation from the real world, but by depth of engagement with it, and who can help build a culture worthy of human beings, living fully, all of them. We need those people, and we need them now. I'm Stephen Blackwood. Thanks for listening. Welcome, everyone, to the Ralston College Podcast. I have the classicist, commentator, and best-selling author, the widely beloved Victor Davis Hanson with me today. Victor, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start off with a little conversation about a book that you wrote in the late 90s, co-authored with John Heath, Who Killed Homer? Who Killed Homer is not simply a history of what's gone wrong in the teaching of the classics, as if that were a fringe academic discipline on which very little depends, but a much larger argument about the foundational role of the Greeks in Western culture, quote, the ideas and values that have shaped and defined all of Western civilization, end quote. And so there's a stirring double meaning in the title, Who Killed Homer, in which the death of Homer is not simply the dying study of the Greeks, but the death of Western culture itself. What are the core values of Western civilization that you see as inherited from the Greeks?
Well, there are many, but the most prominent are constitutional government, or what we would call government by consent of the people, whether that would be a broad-based constitutional oligarchy or republic, or a radical democracy, but nevertheless, it was consensual. And then there was the idea of private property. There's a big debate about the sophistication of the ancient economy, but I think you could make the argument there was a free market. You could also suggest that while they were very religious in nature, there was a strong idea that rationalism would be used to explain natural or scientific phenomena without just reliance on faith or religion or even superstition. There was a constant process of self-critique and self-reflection. So some of the things that they thought were problematic were their own ideas of personal freedom and liberty, treatment of women, slavery. You would have people like Alcadamas saying no man was born a slave, or Antigone or Medea, these numerous Greek tragedies that are named after women, bringing in these issues of style and substance, and that deed must follow word. In addition, I think you can make the argument as well that there was a sense that besides rationalism, there was an idea of skepticism and self-critique of the West itself. There was a sense that human nature was unchanging, and the West offered certain correctives to certain correctives to superstition and ideas about human nature, but it was constantly evolving. There was no idea that if you say something, then free speech, of course, but more importantly, the idea that self-reflection and critique were important. And while there was, you know, Socrates was executed and there was all sorts of abuses, it was always a ongoing idea. And then finally, there was the idea that the rule of law is not predicated on what a Persian king or an Egyptian pharaoh says, that it was codified and it was passed through councils or referenda or votes in the assembly.
I find that persuasive and a stirring account of just how fundamental these things are. Of course, we both know that these ideas evolve or develop, come to fuller understanding in the history of the West, and indeed spread far beyond what we then later come to know as the West. I want to ask you, what are the main ways historically that those core values have been preserved throughout our history?
Well, I think most classicists see sort of a tripartite inheritance. So the Greeks start off these foundational ideas, but there were certain areas that needed to be adapted, modified, rejected, changed. And the first, of course, was Rome, and Rome decided to prefer a republic, a constitutional republic, that rather than what 51% on any given day might decide to do, as was true in some of the democracies among the 1,500 city-states. And they introduced this idea of natio, or nation, that a state would encompass a lot of cities, not just be autonomous city-states. And then there was the third edition of what we sometimes call Jerusalem, or the advent of the Judeo-Christian tradition that had much in common with the classical idea that the duality of a soul and body, an eternal soul, that was somehow its internal existence was predicated on its activity in a corporal form. And while the classical idea had been, you know, punish your enemies and help your friends, not turn the other cheek and Sermon on the Mount, Christianity did become predominant, and so it altered that classical sort of bleak assessment of morality. And between those three pillars, then through the Dark Ages and the Carolingian Age, and then we went into the medieval world, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Reformation, and then the revolutionary ideas and the expansions of freedom and liberty in the American Revolution, and to a lesser extent, I think, in the French Revolution, as well as the British and Scottish Enlightenments. But there was this snowball effect that each century or two centuries, there were layers put on that core of Athens, Rome, Jerusalem, until we come to where we are now. And the danger with all of this is that there were clear people within this system, or thinkers, philosophers, statesmen, politicians, analysts, political scientists, that warned us that the marriage between market capitalism and personal freedom, when it was institutionalized, it would create a lot of wealth, capital. Athens, with a very small population, would be much, much more wealthy than non-Western countries in its immediate vicinities. At least the people would. And when you combine that with giving the individual all sorts of protected liberties, then you would create a what the Romans call luxus, or the Greeks call sort of a decadence. You would have people that would take advantage of that. And so it was very important throughout this paradigm that the family, the tradition, the shame culture, that religion would inculcate a private morality that said, because it's legal and available, it's not desirable, that there had to be some way to check the appetites. And so that's been the big challenge of Western civilization. And you know that from the German nihilists, you know, Hegel and Nietzsche and Spengler, that the West just simply can't curb its exuberance because people are too affluent, or they're too ready to seek their own personal satisfaction at the expense of others. And they have that ability given their economic and political system.
I want to ask you a little bit about the transmission of these values. You mentioned the Carolingians, of course, is the palace court of Charlemagne, which in a way gives a rebirth to these ideals that in a way is right at the heart of what then becomes medieval and then modern Europe. And go back all the way to the academy, the Lyceum in ancient Greek times. I mean, is it possible to sustain these values without a conscious effort to do so through institutions of education, formal, informal, or otherwise?
I don't think so. It's sort of what the French Academy does with the French language, or what the Oxford Dictionary does with the English language, or what every institution that has, you know, core values or founding principles. And what that means is that when the popular culture by osmosis represents these values or enjoys them or abuses them, you get a sort of spiraling effect that there's no one there to say, wait a minute, each iteration you're getting further away from the very things that make you powerful and happy. And if you go in that direction, if you look at the, say, just to take a banal example, if you look at an early Super Bowl halftime show 30 years ago and look at what we're seeing now, where you have nudity and really pornography and pretty divisive language, no one is saying, you know, that reminding the larger culture that that is free to do that. You have free expression. We're not going to censor, but that's going to be deleterious if you continue to do that. It's going to turn off your viewers. It's antithetical to the idea of children watching this. And so that element in Western civilization has to be taught. And that can only be taught by introducing ancient and modern ideas about free speech versus not saying what you're free to speak. Sensibilities for the community or your family. So all of these dichotomies and tensions and contradictions and binaries, they all have to be introduced to the student so that they don't, that they're aware that they're not the only people who are either abusing the system or were angry at its paradoxes, that these are ancient ideas and they have to be taught to people again. So they have some kind of context. Otherwise, they're very arrogant. They just say, well, wow, I have free speech. I can say, you know, anything I want. And there's a long tradition that discusses that. But we've lost that because most people in the core Western first and second year of college are not taught that. It's more therapeutics today.
Yeah, I think, you know, without institutions that preserve and understand and transmit the, well, let's call them the ideas and ideals of a free and flourishing culture, I just don't see how such a culture can survive. I mean, there's certainly no West without that historically, or no Western values, more importantly, which is really what matters, you might say, in the West. Do you sometimes think, I've often been frustrated when I hear sort of so-called, you know, small c conservatives, and I don't mean conservatives as a political entity, though that can be important in the kind of, think about someone like Roger Scruton might be an example of that. But the word conservative really in the deepest sense is just the conserving or passing along of the fundamentals or the inherited wisdom, the lessons of the past. I sometimes wonder whether those who are called conservatives in the States here, you know, often arguing about marginal tax rates and you know, things that perhaps, while maybe important, you know, are really very subsidiary, while the absolute foundations of our culture are undermined by destruction and decay. How do we take our eye off the ball so badly?
I think that there was this utopian idea, especially after World War II, as we became very, very wealthy. We were very successful in World War II. The Western ideas, we were in an existential struggle with communism. We won that as well. And there was a sense that triumphalism, that our system was unmatched. It is. We were very wealthy. We were very confident. We expanded NATO. We had this idea we were at the end of history, and that we didn't really examine the idea that life is tragic. It's not linear. We're not headed towards some utopia. And in that period, we started to let down our guard about the ancient enemy of relativism. So we said, you know, you're not really free because there's this contradiction here. Or in 1828, you did this. And we started to go back into the past and apply standards of the present to turn it from tragedy into melodrama. And we were very self-righteous. And then we started, each particular group, we started out trying to address the inequality among blacks and whites, which we had a long bad record about, but not necessarily any worse than anybody else in terms of racial tension, but worse for us because we had in America much higher aspiration. So we needed to address that. But then that sort of took a life of its own and got us to where we are now, where each person identifies by a particular status or class or gender or race or ethnic background and sees themselves as somehow aggrieved and has complaints or writs against the majority population. That's one of the biggest problems we're having. The other is that all of the levers of influence today, because of globalization and because of affluence and because of Silicon Valley, it's the information is transferred so widely, and national borders have become irrelevant in that sphere. And nobody, I mean, we're not certain, and we're not proud of the unique singularity of the Constitution, so that people are all confused. And in that vacuum, we have the university, we have Hollywood, we have entertainment, we have professional sports, we have the foundations, we have the media, we have Wall Street, and these are very popular, wealthy, powerful interests. And it's in their interest not to be judgmental, to be ecumenical, in the sense that America is not singular. There's a 7 billion person market. Let's not prejudge the Chinese. Who knows? The Uyghurs, well, that's problematic, but we have $5 billion in endorsements there. Or who are we to say that we shouldn't, you know, that the Europeans don't have gripes against us in NATO, or the United Nations, each nation in the United States is no better than any other nation. Or let's listen to the World Health Organization. They know more about it than the CDC because they represent everybody. So all of that relativism, and when you channel it into these powerful voices and levers on society, it makes it very hard for the people to get a conservative counter voice. And I mean that sincerely. If you look at the major newspaper, there's only two or three major conservative, major radio, just talk radio, not PBS, not NPR. The networks, maybe Fox or Newsmax. The universities, Hillsdale College, you're trying to establish Ralston and doing a good job of it. But, you know, Pepperdine, all of them are under enormous pressure always to liberalize and join the the majority. Because, and then people, they're busy people, and most Americans are urban and suburban, and they understand that when they go teach a class or they go to the insurance office, it makes it much easier to join the majority culture, at least superficially, than to say, wait a minute, I'm not going to, I don't like the use of racial separatism language, or I'm not going to go through indoctrination, or I have a perfect right to express my religious beliefs, or my child is coming home. I don't want them to have explicit sexuality training when they're pre-teenage. So it's very hard to resist those pressures. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to do it.
Gosh, that's sobering. I mean, you bring up the university. I mean, in so many ways, the universities are meant to be the keepers of the sacred flame. And, by and large, they seem to be, asleep at the switch, or in some cases, actively trying to put it out. I mean, you brought up the inversion of the whole logic of expanding freedom according to a sense of the universality of human nature that requires, and by nature we merit and are free, the inversion of that into a kind of reduction of the individual to make them captive to the frame of their immediate contingencies. Not that they don't matter, but rather that they can be taken up into opening up a broader horizon. There's a wonderful line in Socrates that you and Heath mentioned in your book, that that being Greek is not a racial category, not one of blood, but one to which anyone who thinks can belong. I think Socrates says, "Me keti tu genus alates dianoias." This being able to think through is a fundamental, intrinsic human capacity, and it is that allows us to meet on a shared horizon, to engage and counter differences, but to discover a shared human nature. But like you, Victor, I'm very interested in thinking about how these problems came about, which in a way were at a very late hour in Western culture. But I'm even more interested, even at that late hour, in thinking about what can be done. Not lament simply, but rebuilding, building anew, finding ways to transmit to the young the truths and ideals that will enable them to live big and full and beautiful lives. I mean, I sometimes think architecture is a good metaphor. I mean, we can look at the brutalism of the last, 60 or 80 years and simply resign ourselves to living in ugliness, or we can do what Vitruvius did and Palladio did through Vitruvius and Jefferson through Palladio, going back to Vitruvius, and we can return to drink from the stream, to the forms and elevating possibilities of the inherited past. I mean, it's still there for us. We can drink from it. My question is, what do you think the revivification of our country and culture would involve?
Well, ultimately, when you look at all of these problems, whether it's this summer's Antifa protest or BLM protest or popular culture's excesses or profligate spending as a country, whatever it is, there are elements within the university, because half the youth today go to some type of college. And I don't think they're getting, we know that they're under $1.6 trillion in debt. And we know that when they emerge, it's every employer tells us that they do not have the skills requisite for the type of job that they're applying for. That is, their spoken and written abilities in English, their analytical skills. But we also know that they have certain preconceived ideas that can't not be questioned. Climate change was created by humans. It can only be the planet can only be saved in the next 20 years by radical changes or alterations in the economy. The country is inherently racist. There's no hope for it, basically. So we have to have psychological or material redistribution and reparations. Abortion should be abortion on demand, even to the very second of birth. Borders are a 19th century phenomenon. We're in an internet. Again, so where do they get those ideas that make them so arrogant and yet so ignorant? And the answer is the university. And how are you going to change the university? I think you could do a couple of things. One is you've got to get the federal government out of student loans because they have no, universities have no moral hazard. So they jack up their prices. They have all of these administrators that don't contribute to learning and they have no incentive. If they had to guarantee their own loans, I think they would be cost conscious. And then I think if the government wants to stay in the business, then through what we're doing now, people have access to online classes or seminars, and they can be plumbers and electricians and be highly compensated with technical training. The ancient world is full of examples that of people who combine mind and body are much superior to people who are just a perpetual student. So I think a lot of the kids today should be getting technical training or even trade training, and then they can do what we do to investigate and develop their issues and develop their mind. More practically, let's have a national exit test. We have a national SAT or ACT because the universities say all high schools are not equal. Well, all colleges are not equal. So let's find out for an employer or a society at large, when you leave Stanford and you take a test, did that prepare you as well as Hillsdale College? It'd be very interesting to find out. Teaching credentials have really hurt this country because they bring those values that they learn in the School of Education to K through 12. And there's no need for those skills can be learned in a matter of weeks. I mean, I've never had a class on how to teach. I taught 21 years minority kids in classics. I didn't need to know how to grade or any of that stuff. Same thing with community college. You have a PhD and go teach at Fresno City College with no problem. You teach a kid 1 year earlier at high school and suddenly you have to have a credential. So give a student the choice between having a credential and a master's degree in an academic discipline. I think most would choose to have the master's degree. And then I think the universities that have become global banks, Stanford, Yale, Harvard, they have enormous endowments. They're tax-free on the premise that they're not indoctrinating or inculcating people in a partisan political sense, and they are. So I think that it would be time to say, you know what, after the first $1 billion, all the income is going to be taxed. And I think they would, to seek to preserve a nonprofit status, would have to really reform what they're doing. I'm just speaking like this because today I got my list of do's and don'ts from Stanford University as a member there, and they're all ideological and they're not negotiable. What the faculty or senior fellows at the Hoover Institution should and must do, and there's no debate about them. So these are practical things that would change the role of the university within society at large, and then would give people opportunities to disengage from it and not have to subsidize it through their tax dollars. But yet, because of this medium that everybody is using, the internet and Zoom and Skype, there would be, and these online courses, Hillsdale does it, there's opportunities from people from all walks of life to get back to the core idea of a university, that it's there to teach inductive methods of reasoning and to give a person the reference of, you know, math, science, literature, language, philosophy, that will allow them to have some humility about what they don't know.
One of the most toxic aspects of the humanities in recent years is the elitism. You bring this out, you and Heath in Who Killed Homer, is the elitism of their theoretical so-called critical approaches. Articles and books so full of jargon that you can barely, if at all, understand them. I think that has betrayed one of the most fundamental insights, however imperfectly realized it may have been, of Western culture. And that is that even the highest realities are present to all of us, that we are made to enjoy them, that even the lowliest among us has an innate longing for truth, as Aristotle puts it at the beginning of the Metaphysics, for beauty, for understanding. And thus any of us is, and all of us are, the rightful inheritors of the greatest works of art and intellect. They belong to all of us. So, in flagrant resistance to that perverse elitism, can you share with us a scene or two from Homer that you have especially treasured or found especially illuminating in your life?
Well, when you open the Iliad, for example, immediately the theme is that certain people, Agamemnon in particular, but also Menelaus, operate by the argument from authority and rank. And it's very clear that Homer's trying to tell you, based on the value system within the Iliad, that Agamemnon does not have the skills or the in a meritocracy than Achilles does or Ajax does. And so the theme is introduced very quickly that the race, to use the biblical term, the race does not go to the swift and life is unfair. And that's sort of what that whole theme of the Iliad is, that Achilles has to learn that, and later Ajax has to learn that, that people who are competent and outspoken and sort of outliers, independent operators, are never going to get the type of renown and acknowledgement. And Achilles has to finally understand that he's not kingly, but he's better than Agamemnon, but that doesn't mean that people are going to appreciate those skills. And then in the Odyssey, very quickly, there's this idea that one's identity is attached to one's family and where one grew up and the physical surroundings and his loyalty to where he was born and that community. So Odysseus is a very cosmopolitan person. He's all the way over in the coast of Turkey. He wanders by accident, by intent, all over the Mediterranean. And what he has one central theme, and that is, I'm going to get back home. I'm going to restore my family's position in Ithaca. I'm going to, and then when he arrives there and he sees the chaos, I'm going to make sure my son has the same opportunity that I do, that my wife and I want to restore my family. So he's a person who's saying to all of us that, and it's very prominent in Western literature after that, whether it's Thomas Wolfe or James Joyce, that you're wandering around and you're going to be a vagrant your entire life unless you have some sense of bearings and where you came from, where you're going to end up, who your friends are, who was your community, and have some reverence to your parents, your family name. And that's very simplistic, it sounds, but it's fundamental to the Odyssey, and it's completely, you know, gone today. If you see most people and you say, where did you grow up? And what was your family doing? And what would your grandparents do? I'm always amazed when I had students, they'll come up and say, I think my grandfather fought in World War II, but I'm not sure. I said, you're not sure? Well, what years were World War II? I'm trying to figure out. I said, well, what year did he die? I don't know. So they don't have a sense of connection with their family or their house or their place. And I think that's really, you can have a lot of very ambitious, successful people in the economy that have to be mobile and transient and wandering, but not all of them. You need some people who are rooted, and we don't have enough of that. That's at the heart of this whole red state, blue state divide, where you get these newscasters that on election night, they'll just say, there's a sea of red, and we know what Wyoming and Utah and all of it, and then here's California or Washington or D.C. So that divide is with us, and it was with the founders, and that explains a lot of the reasons that the left does not like the Constitution. This idea that senators from states like Montana or Utah get two, and so does California, and there's an electoral college. But when you start looking at these idiosyncratic ideas in the Constitution, you can see what they were saying to us. We do not want a mass, urban, dense population on any given day doing what they want. We want to be balanced by people with very different experiences and backgrounds, and that meant in those times rural. So rural states should have an inordinate amount of say based on their population. And I think that's what's always under question with the left. How do we change that constitutional idea that get rid of the Electoral College, have senators based on population, span the Supreme Court, all of this, and there is a rationale behind it, and that is the quality of result, and we're all going to be faceless urban residents, and we're going to have an elite that dictate to us for our own good, sort of like Platonic Guardian in Silicon Valley or Wall Street. So I think that's the challenge. Those issues were with us from Homer on.
Yes. Yeah. One of the absolute core things there that I think you're bringing out, and which I'm sure must be at work in the relation between your life the relation of your life as a farmer and as a classicist. And one of the tragedies of contemporary academia is that these theories are promulgated by people who are at least for the time being, absolutely insulated from their effects. And so, and I take it that what the founders were thinking and what the Greeks had a sense of is that, I mean, they definitely had a sharp sense of is the ways in which you're always subject to reality. I mean, reality is not a constructivist, you know, a utopia. And if your ideas don't match what's real, you will be destroyed. And I take it there's some sense in which if you're a farmer or you're running a small business or whatever, your worldview has to be informed by whether your ideas work. I know our time is short, though, Victor. If I can just ask you one last question about the young people in particular. You know, every week at Ralston College, we have young people reaching out to us. They're tired of the thin gruel they are fed for education. They're seeking alternatives to the cynicism and skepticism and alienation of contemporary culture. They haven't given up, though. If anything, I see them as hungrier and more determined and more courageous than ever. And the more so, the worse things become. And I want to, just on this topic, before I get to my question, I want to read a beautiful passage from Joran Heath's prose that really is an appeal to greatness of spirit in Who Killed Homer. And here it is. A few, the Greeks and Romans suggest, have got the queer idea into their heads that for their tragic salvation, they must pursue a collision course with fate. Redemption comes to such heroes only from swerving neither left nor right in their struggle to make deed match word. They must, in other words, act, not just think. It is never a question when or if they are to hit the wall, but only how, the acknowledged price of doing in lieu of mere talking. And Achilles, Hector, Prometheus, Ajax, Philoctetes, Alcestis, or Antigone almost enjoys the ensuing collision and the debris of lesser men that their granite-like resolve will send scattering. Such men and women are prepared to face the grand finale, to die for principle. What advice do you have for young people today who seek to resist the dominant forms of materialism, nihilism, and coercion, who seek to live lives of depth, freedom, and courage?
Well, I would say to them that their instincts are well-founded and historically and rationally based, and that they feel like they're outliers or outsiders. That's a good thing. And that will bring them, in the long run, repute and reputation and respect. And what they do not want to do is to join the herd, because the herd, in general, goes in the wrong direction, but recently it's gone, in particular, in the wrong direction. And so I know that when I've looked back at my life, and it's been kind of all over the place, I have regrets, but I don't have any regrets for speaking out or writing something that was controversial or trying to help somebody that came to me and said, you know, they're not going to give me tenure because of my politics. I need some help. And you have to be ready for those situations. So when you get up in the morning, I get up every morning and say, when I open my computer and then I get my email, I answer the phone, there's going to be some thing you don't like happening. And are you up for it today? And if you just hang up and say, I don't want to get involved, or I'm not going to speak out. If I say something, I'm going to get a bad book review of my next book, or my publisher won't like it, or my editor will be tough, or my boss at work, then you're going to live a life of constant compromise. And that's not an advocacy of looking for trouble. Trouble will find you quickly enough without much help on your part. You know, trouble will always find somebody. But what I'm getting at is that be prepared for it. And how do you be prepared? Read, be active, be an active participant in your community, and then anticipate when you say something or you see somebody saying something, you're going to say, you know what? That's going to get a big pushback. And if that statement or that behavior to you seems rational and defensible, then defend it. If it doesn't, then say, you know what, you're just a troublemaker, but you have to get a consistent way of thinking. But so that's what I try to do, that I say to myself, I got up this morning, let's see what's on the plate. And usually it's what are you going to do, Victor? Are you going to, you know, do this or this or this or that? And over the long term, not the short term. Short term is aggravating, and you lose your reputation, you get attacked. I'm saying over the long run, you'll feel better about yourself, and things will work out better for you. And that's partly because that's partly a classical idea of hubris versus nemesis, that those that are hubristic and arrogant get theirs. But it's also Christian, and it's, as Socrates said in a pre-Christian, nobody can hurt your soul. I'm not going to damage my soul. And so I think that's very important for young people. They are looking for heroism and occasions to be heroic in a very unheroic society that values, you know, conformity and consensus, and we're all going to be victims, and we want to find somebody in our cancel culture online or Twitter or Facebook that we can all mob and destroy. But they're looking for people to say, you're not going to do this. You just aren't going to do this. If we have thousands of colleges and universities, and the public is desperate for one college president to say, you know what, the next SOB that goes into a lecture hall and shouts somebody down or hits somebody over is going to be expelled. No condition. Or next person who comes into a classroom and disrupts it. And they want that. But nobody will do it because they think they'll be fired. They probably will be fired if they do it. But if enough people do it, they all won't be fired. Most of these people are not going to go out and starve. So I see people every day out here during this lockdown, and they take risk. And when they lose, their little barbershop shut down, or their long-haul trucking truck, their independent-owned truck is over with. So they put up with a lot more risk and consequences than do our elite. And yet our elite are far more timid than the people who are actually taking risks and exposed. And with that...
I don't think there's ever been a time in which we need those everyday heroes to emerge. I know there are many, many young people who will appreciate those words. Victor, you're a friend to all those who seek to know and speak the truth. Thank you very, very much for your witness to the depth and complexity and power and abiding illumination of the truth itself, and especially as it has come to be known by the ancient Greeks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Ralston College podcast. Today's guest was the classicist, writer, and almond farmer, Victor Davis Hanson. Hanson is unbelievably prolific, the author of literally thousands of articles and many books, including The Other Greeks, The Family Farm and the Agrarian Roots of Western Civilization, A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War, and the book that featured in today's conversation, co-authored with John Heath, Who Killed Homer? I want to leave you with a stirring passage from that book on what it means to really teach the ancient Greeks in the way I think our current cultural crisis demands. I quote, "It is to take the Greeks to heart, to match their words with our deeds, to be an Odysseus who can charm, lead, fight, suffer, sacrifice, and keep an eye on what it is all for and how we can get back home. To be an Achilles who sees the wall approaching and with a perverse glee puts the pedal to the floor." I'm Stephen Blackwood. Till next time.